last year or so since we really got the full amount of data in, and trying to do a collaborative project with the industry on 2,000 industry bulls using these high-density chips. So a little background overall, most of this is getting to be old hat at BIF, I think, for what some of this is. Basically, the whole basis for this project stems out of the concept called whole genome selection, using genotypes of thousands of genetic markers. In this case, it'd be the 50K chip, and trying to use those markers to predict breeding values. You heard today from Sally talking in the main session some of the results of that sort of effort. This would be the same idea. And basically, the genetic differences in the DNA are what cause our phenotypic differences, just like you've been hearing from scientists here at BIF for years. Basically, the impetus for most of this work over the last couple of years has been the development of the bovine 50K SNP50B chip from Illumina. It arose from a collaborative effort, as Dr. Taylor said this morning, between University of Missouri, Alberta, and then some two USDA locations within ARS. And it has given us a lot of opportunity for genomic selection, especially, as Kurt said today, within the dairy industry right now. Out on center, including the 2000 Bro project, we've genotyped over 6,000 animals with this chip so far, but we're still in the learning phase about exactly how to use all this data, and not everything's exactly as easy as we thought it was going to be. The whole time. I'm getting some feedback here. Yeah. Is that better, or still hear an echo? Okay. Maybe I'll try a little further down, see if that helping. Does that help? Can you still hear me, or is that too quiet? Okay, so moving on with that then, the start of the 2000 Bull Project was a project that happened about 3 years ago, I guess, later this August. Kind of interesting to think about where some different people in this picture are right here. I see our director, actually, for Neonatal Research Center standing in the back of the room in a different position at that time. Not everybody's the same at all these breed associations. Not everybody's the same in all the scientists. But basically, we had a conference between the breed associations and representatives from the top 16 breeds that register animals and have genetic evaluations of their own. Some help with Kurt Van Tassel, who you saw today. A couple other National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortiums with Dr. Pollock at the time, Dr. Mike Tess, getting together. And coming out of that, basically, we need to try to take the bull by the horns and get a good start on this in a collaborative effort and understand what we can do with whole genome selection and with these high-density chips. Basically, what happened out of that is we at U.S. Neonatal Research Center agreed to genotype 2,000 industry bulls from a representative sample from all these industry breed association cooperators. And run them on that 50K chip so that we could use our data that we were coming from our training data set on center, our germplasm evaluation program, and try to export resulting EPDs from that into the industry bulls that we're genotyping and don't know phenotypes on. That was the idea behind it. Just a little background on what our training data set then was at that time. Basically, most of you are familiar with GP. Those of you that aren't, what was going on at that time was what we called our cycle seven cycles of GPE. Off of cows that were born in 1999 were created based on a cross between the top seven breeds in terms of registration, crossed to some of our base cows on center to produce, the important part, to produce bulls and cows. Those bulls and cows were later made into something that we call F1 squareds. F1 times F1. Get it? Right? Okay. F1 squareds in order to, in order to produce a population that at that time was thought to be very beneficial for linkage analysis to detect QTL, and also served then maybe for some of these linkage disequilibrium analyses that are useful for what we're doing right now with the 50K chip. From that cross, we produced steers and other cows, both of which in certain percentages, are approximately 1,200 steers, approximately 800 heifers, went through feed efficiency facilities, for instance. We genotyped a little over 2,000 animals from that F1 squared population to use as our training data set. Okay. There's a few more animals in addition to that that we genotyped for the chip for this training data, and this is kind of an iteration of where GP has gone. I don't want to go too deep into what this programming is. If you're really interested in it, I'll be talking a little more about it in the crossbreed ETD talk later today. But basically, it expands from just those 7 breeds into sampling from the top 16 breeds in terms of registrations, the same ones that were at that 2000 Bull Project meeting originally. Cross the dams that actually come out of our Cycle 7 population primarily, and produces, again, animals that are phenotyped and continuing to produce progeny in our GP system right now. Okay. Just a quick breakdown then, what we really have then for training data, and what I'm really highlighting today is actually the weights. These are basically the animals that I'm going to talk about that we tried to train on weights to get back to producing something for the 2000 Bull Project. Okay. Obviously, there's other traits in here that could be beneficial to the industry depending on how we can figure out how to exploit that data and take it over to those industry bulls. You guys have probably seen some of this before. This was published in a paper by my colleague Warren Snelling on some work on associations originally. And this just is an idea. I think there was a Manhattan plot that Jerry showed. This is sort of a similar concept to that. Basically shows the significant regions. If you think of this as the whole genome, this is sort of a chromosome by chromosome basis of significant regions for each of these types of traits. And basically just showing every one of these bars is at least a nominal significance for birth weight, wean weight, yearling weight. It just shows that there are genes within each chromosome, especially in some certain chromosomes like this one, that seem to affect all of these traits. And it's kind of the basis for how do you pool all that data together in order to get a genomic prediction to try to take further. And I think that's the issue we're all wrestling with right now. The number of bulls from each breed were sampled somewhat proportionate to the breed size, not directly proportional, but so that basically Angus had the most that were directly sampled in the project, followed by Hereford, and kind of going down from there, winding up into, I think, Bronzy being the breed that was sampled the least. The breed association was responsible for the sires that were chosen for the project. Basically, in general, they were, I believe, predicting high accuracy styles that either were influential or were thought that they were going to be influential over the next few years. This is kind of a final breakdown of the semen that was actually received from breed associations that went into the project, and just gives you an idea of what the proportion of each of these breeds were relative to the 2000 Bull Project, how many semen samples we had from each one. Okay. Since then, we've actually had a few that we've added in a few different places, but this is kind of the official number. And just as a note, the part of the byproduct of this project is that the 50K genotypes have been sent back to the breed associations for them to use however they see fit and try to help develop their own genetic improvement programs using that. So potential pitfalls that we needed to tackle in the project and find out if something like this worked. The important thing to realize is this is a demonstration project that we didn't know the answer to start with. And we needed to do something to take the risk to see if something like this can turn out and help to produce EPDs on a selected set of bulls, basically by extrapolation from a population that was trained on that's not related directly to those bulls. We didn't know how it would work at the time. We didn't know if we'd need more than 50,000 markers. I think, again, Dr. Taylor hinted at earlier today some work on the crossbreeds where you might need more density than the 50K chip actually provides. But our hope was that the knowledge gained from this project would help us decide what we need to do in the future. Just a little bit more about our situation relative to dairy. I said that there was an extremely high amount of success in applying this to dairy. Obviously, some of the differences between dairy, we have a lot more breeds, a lot less relationship really within our breeds than what the dairy associations generally do. There's less AI as a percentage in beef cattle. The traits that we're focused on that we really want to change, I know I'm talking about weight here, but weight isn't the thing that we're all after the most. We're after things like feed intake. We're after things like cow longevity. We're after things like fertility, disease resistance, several things, healthfulness. Basically, stay around in Jack's session and you'll find out about the things we're really interested in the rest of the day. So we're relying on research projects for those phenotypes. And the dairy had the advantage that they have a tremendously track record of producing phenotypes for the trait that's most interesting to change. Okay. And then the other thing here that's a little bit different is we're trying to extrapolate our data. And what I mean by that is we're taking a population that's not necessarily one that would be progeny that are going to be produced in future generations. We're looking at basically a coal steer, crossbred coal steer, trying to take data from there and extrapolate it, infer what the genotypes are going to tell us in a population that's not directly related in the pedigree. So those are just laying out some of the challenges and not trying to sound I'm not trying to sound pessimistic. I'm just trying to lay out what sort of some of the challenges are to these sorts of approaches. To verify the process and how well it works, then we used weight traits, birth weight, wean weight, yearling weight, and analysis from U.S. market data to develop prediction equations for the 2,000 bulls. And basically we took that approximately 4,000 weight records I said that we had genotype animals for, used a process at Iowa State called GenCell-based CPI. I know that doesn't mean anything to most of everybody in the room. Just suffice to say it's a highly accepted process for trying to get these whole genome selection things done and trying to pick out which marker sets would be the best ones to use in the process. Okay. Then as you've been hearing in other situations with BIF or with BIF genetic improvement workshops, the genetic correlations between the 2,000 bull genomic predictions based on that training equation and the EPDs, the deregressed EPDs that we'd be getting from the EPDs of the sires that were chosen for the 2000 bull project would be a function of the proportion of genetic variants explained. And I think that's what Sally talked about this morning really in the Angus Association talk about using the genomic data in genetic evaluation there. You get a correlation between the marker system breeding value and the actual phenotype. That correlation squared is the percentage of variation explained and a function of the accuracy. Okay? So deregressing EPDs, that's kind of a new term. What's going on there and what we need to do to make this comparison is this process called deregressing. What's going on is that the EPDs we get back from breed associations have a property to them that's sort of that they're shrunken predictors of genetic merit. What that really means is that we don't allow a bull, even if it's got the best carcass weight that we've seen on any other bull, we wouldn't allow the breeding value of that bull for carcass weight to be, or the EPD for carcass weight for that bull to get too far away from some sort of zero level without that bull being proven through progeny. Okay? We're kind of waiting on some of that bull's phenotype actually being due to things other than genetic factors. And that waiting factor produces what we call a shrunken estimate. Basically, until we have progeny records that are proving that bull, the EPDs are shrunk not too far away from some average until we can prove that they really are right. Okay? Well, the problem with that is that it creates some property, statistical property problems in trying to compare those EPDs when we want to use it in genomic sorts of tools. And basically, we need to get something from these EPDs that gets back to sort of something that's more like a progeny average rather than really what an EPD. Deregression basically gets us back to something that's a lot like a progeny average instead of an EPD. Okay, so that kind of makes sense. This is a method, again, that comes from Dorian's group that we use this. We had a little bit of problem in convergence in trying to look at the variance components to get that genetic correlation between the deregressed EPDs, depending on a property called weighting, which basically is a function of the accuracy of the EPD, how many progeny did that animal kind of have that went into that EPD in the beginning. We modeled traits under different scenarios, but we're really still trying to find the best for each trait. We've got a student at U.S. Neonatal Research Center that's made a lot of progress in this summer, one from Alison Van Eenenum, and she'll be working on that through part of the rest of the summer to see what the best sort of strategy will be. But we do have some preliminary results then based on those analyses. The important part is over in the right column. And basically, we're getting a correlation, a genetic correlation, across several different of these weighted analysis results for birth weight of somewhere around 0.4%. We're getting a correlation for yearling weight somewhere around 0.3. And weaning weight right now, I'll just be honest, is kind of screwy, and we're trying to track down what's going on with that. It might be our own training data. It might be something that we're doing with these weighting factors that I mentioned on the previous slide. And we're going to track down what that is and see what's going on. But right now, that's kind of positive. We're not getting, I think when we went into this 3 years ago, we were thinking we were going to get somewhere around 80 or 90%. I think we're realizing things about breeds and trying to predict from one breed to another. Dr. Taylor alluded that earlier. Some of these breed-specific sorts of predictions might be more accurate on that 50K panel than trying to take the crossbred data and extrapolate to the purebreds. Okay. So linkage disequilibrium is not necessarily the same in all breeds. Genome-wide selection likely requires more records and higher density markers when extrapolating, and we're still working on possible solutions such as breed of origin effects. What I mean by that is when we look at our markers, we're basically coming from 7 different breeds in that cycle 7 population and from 16 different breeds in the new GPE. If we can get an idea if that marker on the 50K chip came from an Angus or a Hereford, we might get an idea that, hey, the LD seems to be holding up for the Angus, and there is an effect of that marker as long as the origin of that marker came from Angus relative to whether that origin of that marker came from a Hereford. And maybe there'll be one that's a neighbor, 10 markers down that works for Hereford better, for instance. Okay. Our primary assumption has always been that when we find SNP markers, and that's what these panels are markers that are associated with causal mutations. The challenge really seems to be, how do we go forward? And I think we're dealing with this as an academic group altogether. How do we go forward to finding markers that hold up across populations? You end up with training data sets with high significant results for 15 markers all in a row, and you want to pick one of those out of there that seems to be explaining the most variation. It's very difficult to do that without a second population that you try to pick which of those 15 would work the best. Okay. I just want to explain that a little bit more in sort of a graphical form for everybody here. If we're talking about selecting markers for causal variation, we've got a mutation that's important for a trait of interest that's M on this graph, and these are chromosomes all across here chromosole segments for several different animals. Okay, so maybe this could be animal one and it's two chromosomes. Maybe that's animal two and so forth throughout this chart. Okay, we've got markers A, B, and C, right? And if I look at that and look across here, you see that capital A is in association with capital N. Okay, and on the next chromosomal segment, little a is in association with little m. Okay, if you look at markers B and C, well, B doesn't seem to fit that pattern. Okay, what I take from that, if I knew this information right here already, B is not a very good predictor, at least for those two chromosomal segments, of M. Okay, A is very good on those two. C, little c is associated with big M, and big C is associated with little m. That still holds up at the level of those two. But if you keep going down, A is still holding up, same relationship. Suddenly we have a big C with a big M, and our C falls out of bed in this small example. Okay? If you look through here then, really only marker A always appears in the same phase with the mutation throughout here. And if you think about this, let's say this is one of our breed-specific markers for A. I could go out and find out that another breed, marker A no longer works, but marker C is now the best. Or I could go out and find in another breed that marker A still works the best, but it's the little a instead that's associated with the big M instead of the big A. Okay, that's sort of a graphical representation of what we're trying to deal with, and how to do that the best is a little difficult when we really don't know what M is. I'm going to close some slides from Dr. Snelling had produced this for me from what's called a leakage disequilibrium analysis for several of the breeds that were involved in our cycle 7 discovery population. And the important thing of this right now is the red. Okay, this is one chromosome, chromosome 6, looking all across it for each of the markers on the 50K chip. And it's not quite all of the markers, is it? All the way across one, it's kind of a subset. But if you look across here, you get these little areas of red, and what that means is you've got these pieces of high LD where markers kind of adjacent or nearly adjacent in this triangle seem to have phases that match in that region. Okay, that'd be a place where the big A seems to be always going with the big M on my example before. Okay, and if you look across here all the way, you see that Angus has kind of a big pattern over here, maybe even goes all the way out here, but certainly has some nice little spiky triangles up there that show those high LD areas. If you look at Hereford, you suddenly see kind of a different area open up and maybe not as much red over here, as an example. And you look at Simmental, we don't have anything that's coming all the way out here anymore, but we have these kind of regional places that are in a different place than what the Hereford and Angus were. Okay? The last one I'll stop on, this is what it looks like in our training population as a group, okay, and where we're at right now. And it comes partly from our what happens with our cross-bred population and how we need to deal with that. We end up having sort of an artificial linkage all the way down into several other spots. We still have those close little triangles up here at the top that explain regional LD, but we have some patterns that seem to extend down a lot further. There's two different reasons for this. I'll talk about them later, but one is that we have a lot of sire families from the same sire. We did multi-sire mating to produce these. What we actually have is some artificial linkage in this population that's probably being created because several animals have the same sire. Okay, so they end up inheriting similar chromosomal segments based on their sire. Okay, the second thing is we're probably seeing some merging of those LD patterns just because of the number of breeds that are going into this overall. Okay. This is one more graphical representation, also from Dr. Snelling, looking at linkage disequilibrium for a haplotype that we had for where that spike was on chromosome 6. And this is sort of what is the relative linkage with that haplotype for a small region from here to here of chromosome 6. And the interesting thing about this is you kind of have three patterns of linkage disequilibrium depending on the breed, where this is our base discovery population, Hereford Angus, Red Angus, Charolais, Limousin, Simmental, Gilvie. And you kind of have three different sorts of patterns here. You have the one right here where everyone basically has an LD of 1 in that region with the haplotype that seems to be explaining variation in weight. Okay. You have the one, let me see here, right here, where Angus, for instance, has a highly positive, has markers that would be highly in a positive linkage disequilibrium with the weight, and the Charolais is negative. So you kind of have that case where you'd have a flipped LD pattern. And then you have several others that basically have nothing there, like Red Angus, for instance. And then you have cases where some of them are high and some of them are nothing. Those are kind of the three different scenarios you could see. The important thing, I think, is, and we need this cross-breed representation to tell this, is trying to sort out, if I were going to use one of these for that weight haplotype, it looks like something like this would be the best one, the best region to pick. It's the same positive relationship for all of the breeds. Okay? Pockets of LD are not consistent across breeds. That's what I want you to take home from this. It explains why breed-specific panels can be much more effective, and it explains why higher density panels may help across breeds. It also means we have an increased need for phenotypes. If you know most of us up here, we never really stop asking for those. So, mixtures of breeds in the U.S. SMART population can show greater extent of LD across the chromosome. A lot of that's due to the structure of that large half-sib groups. I just want to show you another project we've been playing around with. I've shown this in a couple groups before and try to show you some things about that relates more to sort of these LD patterns across groups. This is another chart that actually Warren came up with originally that got us thinking about this line. Several of you have seen this. Basically looks at what is the genomic distance between different breeds in the 2000 Bull Project. And I think it's pretty interesting, not surprisingly, especially with the underrepresentation of indicus markers on the 50K chip, you see Brahman way over here relative to the other breeds. Okay? But after that, you kind of see some patterns, some of which make sense and some of them which don't. For instance, Hereford seems to be kind of segregated off on its own away from some of these other breeds. You've kind of gotten a continental group that's up here somewhat together. You've got the indicus crosses, most of which, except strangely enough for Brangus, seem to be on the pathway back from Brahman. And then you've got Angus and Red Angus very close to each other, not surprisingly, and a few other stragglers here that may be partly due to representation in the 2000 Bull Project, but also probably show some distance. Kind of interesting seeing the relationships between these breeds and gets us thinking, can we predict breed frequency if we take an animal off the street from the feedlot and find out what is that animal in terms of breed composition from the 50K chip? Can we exploit these breed distance to determine breed composition? And it's a relatively simple procedure we used. It's basically a regression of animal genotypes on breed gene frequencies and breed composition in a four-way, that same discovery population, actually I mentioned earlier, those cycle 7 F1 squareds, we determined best basically with an average accuracy in the 90% of what the breed composition of that four-way was. Okay. This is just a look at that from a statistic. We're actually still working on what statistic would be the best for this. This is an example of how well we're predicting breed composition using the 50K chip. as a model. So I think that's kind of interesting. Application-wise, I think it could be important right now. Obviously, it's too expensive, unless you're an AKC dog breeder, to go out and buy a chip and see what kind of breed you have in your mutt. But I think it could be kind of useful if we think about how we combine samples from, say, feedlot sources, and the feedlot operator wants to know from this group of animals in some DNA test what is the breed composition of most of those animals, things to that end. And obviously, we've talked about marker-assisted management for years. Part of marker-assisted management might be trying to manage breed complementarity differences on feedlot behavior. Things like that could be applications of something like this. So with that, I hope you enjoyed that. We want to keep working on the 2,000 bulls for the breeds, especially both in terms of trying to see how we can make our phenotypic training data better, and also in terms of being able to use the EPDs from those breeds to develop breed-specific panels and things like that from those EPDs and the genotype bulls. So with that, I'll go ahead and take any questions. Guys are making this easy for me. You mean in terms of a fine of being related to a trait? That's a good question. I think generally in some of the results I've seen it, and some of the ways we've cut things down, you know, I think there were about 2,000 different markers, somewhere around there, 2,000 to 3,000 different markers that were showing up for some of our weight traits. A lot of that are not independent. Basically, it's one marker that's showing up, but it's also an LDE with another marker that's showing up, really explaining the same variation. Cutting that down, you know, I think we're still looking at hundreds of effects, but probably needing multiple markers to explain those hundreds of effects for the most part. Yeah, that's a good question, too. I'm going to borrow from Missouri. Is there anybody from University of Missouri here right now from Jerry's group? Looking for Jerry's group. If I remember right, they were coming up with somewhere around 50-some peaks when they originally were looking at this. I thought that was for tenderness at the time. I might be getting mixed up with marbling, but I knew that was a good data set to look at. We're probably finding something close to that in terms of markers and regions of markers when we've looked at our own data for that. But it's a tough trade, and we, in order to get it up above that 50, they're probably just really minuscule types of effects that are hard to detect without a whole lot of bulls or a whole lot of steers that have been slaughtered. You know, we're still looking at a lot. We happen to find two of them, as you mentioned, that explain a whole lot of the variation. And getting below those two, two of them are like finding a redwood in a wheat field, right? And after that, we got to find the oats in the wheat field. It's tough to find. Yeah, those two regions seem to be showing up. And Tara McDonald and Warren Snelling have looked at that closer, but I don't know if there's anything else besides that I'm forgetting. I know those regions light up pretty well for the most part. You're on the spot. Nothing else offhand? Okay. Yeah, those two are still showing up.
No. CIF, thanks for being a contributor here at the Emerging Technology Committee, and let's give Larry Knight.